Blake Murphy is here. Looks good.
Thanks,
man. You're a TV guy now. Do you think you're more of a TV guy now than a podcast guy?
No.
Think you're more of a TV guy than a writer?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah. I miss writing, but yeah. I missed writing until on Saturday, Grange and Gary Mello asked me last minute, hey, could you write off this Raptors-Wizards game? Grange isn't doing it, and we have no one available. And I was like, I do miss writing. I don't miss writing about Raptors-Wizards at the end of the tankathon season for both teams.
So sometimes I'm envious of shows and writers who get to focus on one sport because it's just a way more manageable workload in terms of how much you need to pay attention to, right? Like, I pay attention to the four major sports and then other stories surrounding them, right? But this is the time where I go, I'm good. Is a Raptors season like this one where, yeah, I didn't watch Raptors Wizards. I saw that on the schedule and I went, I don't need to do this to myself. I went to Raptors Thunder, which I just wanted to see Shea, but it was so bad, Blake, that I couldn't even enjoy the game. I couldn't even enjoy Shea. I couldn't enjoy the Thunder.
And that's a game where, like, relative to the standard the Raptors have been playing to, you got three spirited quarters out
of them. That's what I'm saying. But you can't do it because there's no stakes. There's no stakes to any of the games, and it's kind of painful. There was a moment where I was cheering for the non-tank, right? Hey, get out of this lottery. And I'm already saying I was right. Before they take their pick, anybody who's followed March Madness this year and saw the two Kentucky guards who, if they stand on each other's shoulders, are an NBA player. They're as tall as our new guy, Mike Jose. If they stand on each other's shoulders, the two guards at Kentucky are 6'5". And Cody Williams, who to me looks like he weighs maybe 138 pounds at 6'10", and can play 10 minutes in an elimination game for the Colorado Buffaloes. It's not great. Those are the top guys in this draft. So I was cheering for that, but even that is gone. Even that is gone. And, you know, I was actually thinking of, I'm trying to do a segment and put together a segment, and I was thinking about it yesterday. I was talking about this with Ben, like a Simpsons monkey paw. Remember that, where it's like you make a wish, but the wish becomes the worst reality, or there's always a catch with the reality. Yeah. And to me, the Raptors have a monkey paw scenario, which is the Raptors will pick a direction, but it ends up being in the most unwatchable Raptors basketball in decades. This is even worse than the Tampa season. The Blue Jays, monkey paw, this is the way to kind of pivot into them. All the fans ever wished for was meaningful September baseball. But that's actually all you get. Is it's meaningful, those series against the Rangers, but you lose all the games. It's meaningful, those playoff games that you've gotten, but you're never going to win any of them. So congrats. You have Simpsons monkey pod your way into this Toronto Blue Jays team. All right, maybe we'll come back to the Raptors. But of right now, I want to talk Jays with you. So as a good beat writer, or like a good beat writer, I'm trying to come up with different angles for different guests on the Blue Jays all week long, right? And with you, you're my math guy, okay? You're Mr. Numbers. Today, I want Mr. Numbers to explain to me, buy or sell, essentially, positive, negative, or just reasonably the same, right? When it comes to regression. Because that is one of the biggest stories of this Blue Jays season, is who is going to have positive regression? And we've basically built this as, well, Vladdy, we've already seen his floor. He's got to go up. Or Varsho, we've already seen his floor. He's got to go up. Well, Bo had an actually down season by his standards. Springer had a down season by his standards. You go across the board, and basically, the Blue Jays couldn't find four players that actually produced for them above what their expectations were, right? It was Kevin Kiermaier, Babe Schneider, and
Brandon Belt.
Danny Jansen and Brandon Belt.
Like, Belt was their third best hitter from, I think, May 1st on.
Yeah, he's not on the team anymore. They decided, hey, guess what?
Because he's 100 years old.
For sure. But they also replaced him with a guy who's actually older than him. So yes.
Yeah, they employ the two oldest players in baseball right now, which is really fun.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Once
Votto's on the team. Yeah. Justin Turner and Votto are, I believe, the two oldest players.
Just learned that the reason why we put commas between three digits or dashes between numbers is because our brains can only process so many numbers at once.
Right.
Usually the max for people is 7. Okay, so 7 numbers in a row.
That's why it was such a big deal when we moved to including the area code and phone numbers.
Yeah.
When I first started, when I had 6227207 locked in there for so, and then I'm like, oh, I got to do 519627207.
That's tough.
Even though every number starts with 519, it's way tougher
it's
to
harder.
Lock that in. Yeah. And then phones came on, and none of us will, like, my mom's number is the only number that I know.
Yeah.
But
I used to have that. I think it would be tough for me to even get that one now. I gotta dig deep for my mom's number.
I won't say it out loud.
Yeah.
I almost said it to prove it, and then.
I thought you meant mine.
No,
like,
no,
that was a good mom joke where you were like, I could say your mom's number.
Yeah, that would have been.
Yeah, that would be better.
I almost said my mom's out to like prove that I remember it, and then Denise would have been getting some texts.
Yeah, that's probably true. So essentially, where I'm going with that is, I'm gonna try to limit the numbers because I think there's only so many things that people can actually process. But I want to do positive regression, negative regression, or mostly ends up staying the same. So let's start with the number one guy, which is Vladimir Guerrero Jr., right? Because I think a lot of it has been, if you're looking at the mantra from spring that I talked with Arden Zwelling about and that Barker did a great job outlining on Blair and Barker the other day, it's do damage on what you can do damage on, okay? So they're trying to be more selective. They're trying to be more patient at the plate. But that wasn't the entire thing with Vladdy last year. He was barreling baseballs. He was putting balls in the air. And a lot of the numbers actually indicated that he was supposed to be having a much better season than the one that he had, especially when it comes to the home runs and the extra base hits. So when you're looking at this year, where do you think Vladdy fits in this picture from positive, negative regression? I'll actually frame it this way, because I think it'd be hard to say negative regression for him. How big of a positive regression are you actually looking at with him?
And that's the biggest question. So I'm reasonably optimistic Vlad is going to bounce back. But the big warning flag, first of all, when it comes to Vlad's actual output versus expectations, I think that, his actual output versus like the analytic, what we expected kind of stats. I think Vlad is having an interesting career in two important ways. And one is a reminder that even over the course of a whole season, those things don't even out, right? Like if you're at the leaderboard at the start of the season in expected, the gap in your actual slugging versus expected slugging, there's nothing that says that's got to catch up by the end of the year. Yeah. In fact, you know, that, and I've talked about this before on Jays Talk Plus, is like part of why I like looking at the numbers and the expected stuff is the like secret sauce, the black box between this happened and this is what we expected to happen is like, that's the like magic part, right?
That's
like
sports. That's what's fun.
Exactly. That's what we're trying to figure out. That's what teams are trying to figure out. So I think it's really interesting in that sense. The other is that I don't know how close we are to getting this data, but the best theory I've heard for why some guys sustain gaps between actual and expected has to do with the spin that gets put on a ball off the bat. Mm. So a big part of Jose Bautista's breakout was the ability to change how he was hitting the ball in terms of the spin and how that carries. Any golfer can tell you, what that feels like or how you add yards to your drive by adding that extra little spin and the way it slices through the air, right? Now, we don't have that yet. I've heard some good theories on, hey, there's too much backspin on the way it comes off the bat. I don't know how to fix that. Jose Bautista famously fixed it. But I do think at some point in the next couple years, that's something we'll have numbers on and be able to maybe figure out why Vlad could hit the ball so hard and it doesn't leave the park sometimes. Now, to your actual question, I am reasonably optimistic. The reason for pessimism is basically this. So these projection systems, they don't just spit out a number. They spit out a what would happen in the worst case scenario? What would happen in the best case scenario? What would happen in the medium, like the average scenario? And then we use the average scenario. If you go on someone's FanGraphs page and you see their projection line or whatever, that's the 50th percentile. That's like the medium outcome. What worries me is that if you look at the high, high, high end of the outcomes, these systems are no longer optimistic that Vlad can even get back to 2021 level. So that's only 2 years ago. And even with the cold, not cold second half, but he cooled off after the hot start. He had a 166 WRC plus, so about 66% better than league average at the plate. The 90th percentile for Pecota right now, Pecota is Baseball Prospectus's projection system, they have him at 155, which is really, really good.
Yep.
That is like you are on some MVP ballots. You're a top 10 hitter in baseball. But even in the 90th percentile, almost everything has gone right projection. Vlad is not as good as 2021.
He was 167 OPS plus that year.
Yeah. So this is saying
it's
150.
It's a marketable difference.
Yeah. We're saying 150. Yeah. That's going from the best hitter in baseball to like a 8 to 12 range best hitter in baseball. Still awesome for your baseball team. But
not MVP.
It's a little concerning that these systems, even though that's only 2 years ago, look at it and say he's not getting back to that level.
You know what, though? I don't know how many people, maybe there's still some people left over that need it that way. I think that if you're looking at it from a marketing standpoint, you need to have it that way because every team wants to have a player that you could say is one of the best at their sport. But to me, that's more become, if you were asking to me anyways, the average Blue Jays fan, who needs to be the MVP this year? I think most would answer Bo now.
Yeah, I mean, Bo, like, because he plays a premium position and has improved to, like, average at that position defensively, like, he's got the clearest path to posting, like, a six-win season or whatever that gets you in the MVP discussion. Vlad is just like, because you play first base, and even if you're good at first base defensively, it's not valuable. Like, you have to be the best hitter in baseball to get in that conversation. It's why last year was so frustrating where, like, yeah, he was an above average hitter, but he's like 35th among first basemen.
I was going to say he wasn't even an above average first baseman.
So in terms of the optimism,
the baseline projection
says Vlad will be even better than 2022 at least. Like, in a normal scenario, he's bouncing back to like a 135 OPS plus. That's not game changing.
I was going to say that's barely better than that
year,
but
yeah, it would be.
But we're
talking about your baseline. Yep. You're not factoring in, hey, he came into camp trimmer and in better shape. You're not factoring in, hey, maybe the knee and wrist stuff from last year is gone. You're not factoring in any of that. You're not factoring in how good his spring has been at the plate. And you're still saying, well, yeah, he's going to be better than the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. So I think that speaks to just how big the talent level is here and how much had to go wrong last year. The thing I'm most curious about is, like, on the way up, and I know he's only hit 300 1 year, but the hit tool was supposed to be so good that even when the power slumped, this was a guy who would still hit like 280. And that, you know, obviously Vlad hitting 280 and slugging like 350 for a month isn't great, but there's that floor established, right? Of like, even when he's slumping, he's contributing. And last year we didn't see that at all. Like, he hit 260 last year, 260, 265 last year. And that's not there. So that's, I'm curious if that comes back, if we see some more of that, you know, the bat to ball part of his profile. But obviously people mostly just care. We're going to get back to, you know, 35, 40 dingers.
So that's kind of it for me is when you say the baseline is supposed to be better than 2022, I go, yeah, his OPS was 818.
Yeah.
That's not.
Like, would you be happy if he got that into the 850, 875 range? In the, like, keeping in mind that the league average was 715 last year.
Yeah, I'd be happy. But I think for this to be what I would call a resounding success season for Vlad, the OPS has to start with a 9.
Okay.
That's going to be, to me, if you're, because part of the conversation with him is he going to be one of the pillars of your franchise? And I don't think he's a pillar as a first baseman with an OPS that starts with an 8.
No, I mean, you're certainly not to the extent of, you know, the contracts that we were kicking around ago.
That's what I mean is you're talking in right now. This is a make or break season for the Bo, Vladdy, you two guys at the center of this core, you two guys being built around. To me, Bo is basically a near guarantee. Yeah. I wish that the Blue Jays would have already negotiated a contract with him. I know some people are dubious in terms of how he's going to age out, especially defensively.
I mean, yeah, if he has to move to second base or left field
whatever.
Or something like
that. I just think
but that's a couple years away.
I'm willing to gamble on a guy that is consistent with the bat every single season, who's always going to be a hits leader, and also has the best work ethic on the team. Like, those are just, I'm fine with that. If you don't end up with surplus value on the contract, okay, so be it.
Surplus value is for guys on the way up.
Yeah,
like, no free agent contract or next contract, or I shouldn't say no, but it's very, very rare for any of those to be, like, surplus value in terms of, like, dollars per win and stuff like that. It's, like, this was the whole plan, is, like, while Vlad and Bo, and to a lesser extent Manoah and Kirk and those guys are inexpensive, they're controllable, they're in arbitration or whatever, that's when you go out and spend on veteran free agents and, like, Springer's not returning surplus value, but he's a vet who you can put in and is worth, you know, was for the first couple years.
We'll see. That's next.
Yeah, was for the first couple years worth the contract. Yeah. You know, you get all these pitchers, and they've done really well hitting on these pitcher contracts. Yeah. But, like, when you pay a pitcher $25 million a year, $20 million a year.
No, you're not getting surplus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and that's okay. Once guys get to that point, the challenge for the front office is if you're going to pay guys what they're worth, eventually, you got to have the next wave of inexpensive guys. And that's kind of, as the Jays enter this season, where everything should feel really, really urgent because Bo and Vlad only have 2 years left, and the veteran free agents they have are, you know, a year further into their contract, a year further into the 30s, is the farm system's the weakest in the AL East. Like, you can like some of their prospects.
It's one of the weakest in all
baseball.
But
there's not that wave. Yeah, you talked to Jeff Ponce recently about, and look, there's some nice stuff happening with the teens down at the complex from what it sounds like.
Sure.
But that's far down the line. Like, Arjun Namala is not helping this team during the Bo Vlad, maybe at the tail end of a Bo Vlad window, but not anytime soon. So that's the concern. You're not concerned with, hey, Bo is now going to get paid what he's worth. It's if we pay Bo what he's worth, where do we find the talent to surround him? That's not a Bo Bichette issue. That's a front office issue.
Okay, so then I'm going to get in. Then let's knock off the three guys that I think represent the potential for surplus value. Because then I'm going to get into the
negatives,
the positive or the potential negatives or how bad the regression is going to be. But let's go to the three guys, because I don't even think it's worth really doing Bo. I think he had a down season, but ultimately it is what it is with Bo Bichette, right? Like, we don't need to go over this.
And, like, the down season was, like, so much of that was tied up in, like, well, he got hurt a couple times. He probably rushed back from everything, it seemed like. And, like, he started the season so well that it felt like he's also got this consistency thing going where he's basically been the same guy OPS-wise.
And when it comes to, hey, he's going to change his approach, dude, he's the dead last guy that I'm picking in terms of, that's actually going
to
happen.
The only thing I want from Bo this year in terms of, like, hey, like, I would like to see you do something different or do something more. In 2021, he went 25 for 26 stealing bases.
Yeah.
He attempted 8 steals last year.
Yeah.
I would like to see him get back to a little bit of that.
It was weird because one of the big stories at a Jays camp last year was, hey, the bases are bigger and everybody's going to steal. And then,
the Jays were bottom 10 in stolen base attempts.
Yeah, and they kept. They said, like, Whit Merrifield's going to steal. And they were like, no, he's old now. He's not doing that.
Are you going to use the steal pivot to one of the guys here?
No, actually, I'm just going to keep with the... So I've got three guys, and you can tell me if you're going to add anybody to this list that are the highest candidates for surplus value, right?
Okay.
So let's start with Dalton Varsho, because a big part of that trade was the contract. Hey, you've got a controllable guy who we actually think has a lot of upside. And it turned out, last year anyways, that not only did the upside not materialize, he showed a brand new version of his downside offensively. And I know most of it happened at home. It was a very weird season. I do think that there was a big mental component to this.
Absolutely.
But
I think that is, you know, you talk to people around the team and stuff too, like the last couple weeks, and it seems like the weight, and Barrios dealt with this too, right?
Yeah.
Of like, you got the contract, you got the ball early and not opening day, but
too.
Yeah. Or he got the ball 2 years ago on opening day. He got a 2020. Yeah. So like, you get that, you get the contract, you get the pressure. And in Varsho's case, it wasn't the contract, but like, yeah, you don't think he was looking over at Gabriel Moreno's stat line once in a while?
Well, and I just think he was the figurehead of the Blue Jays offseason and their new...
He kind of became an avatar of the front office's approach to the offseason in a way that wasn't necessarily fair to him, but that's, you know, like you always say, that's what the money's for.
No, his best moments of the season were bookends. He started the season, the opening game, right, on the road. He comes up with a massive RBI. And then he ends the season with a bomb that people thought was going to be basically season changing and was going to result in him being the man again in a huge spot for the Jays. That ultimately, I think, ended up in a loss. But either way, Dalton Varsho, how confident are you that there is going to be a significant positive regression? And like, where do you see this thing kind of topping out, or where do you see the improvement manifesting itself the most?
So I think this is probably the guy I'm most confident in being better than last year.
Yeah. Part of that is floor.
Yeah. I mean, part of that is if you are an elite defensive outfielder, like he was bad at the plate last year and was still worth about 2 wins.
Sure. I gotta be honest though, I really don't care about that stuff because it's like you could get Bradley Zimmer flying around out there if you're gonna
Nathan
have
Lucas
him
is on the roster.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Didn't need to
trade Gabriel Moreno for a defensive outfielder.
Oh yes. This is not to say there's Dalton Varsho would probably have to win MVP for me to feel okay with giving away a franchise catcher. You know how I feel about catchers. It hurts a lot, especially with, like, no disrespect to Brian Servin and his new swing path and stuff like that. But Anyway, so yes, the floor there is significant, but with Varsho, so first of all, his projection, since again, I don't live by these things, but you asked me to bring them, his baseline projection, like 50th percentile outcome, league average hitter. And if you are a plus defender in center field and left field and a very good base runner, league average bat gets you to probably like a 4-win season if you stay healthy.
I was going to say 85 OPS plus last year.
Yeah.
674 OPS.
So he's pegged at 99.
Yeah.
For this coming year, which is a nice, it's in line with his 2021, which was he played 2/3 of the season and hit at that level. He had his 2022 before they traded for him was fascinating because, like, again, I know you don't put as much value in the, you know, how much value you're getting from defensive base running and stuff like that, but almost nobody in the history of baseball has had a 5-win season with an OBP below 300, and he almost did. He had a 302 OBP and was worth like 4.9 wins.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So this guy can do a lot without checking that OBP box that someone like me usually really values. Now, he's had a better spring in terms of plate discipline, what he's laying off, and things like that. But I think, look, last year, the thing that was missing most at the plate, like, he struck out and walked the same amount as before, made roughly the same amount of contact. The power wasn't there. This is a guy who they expected to hit 25, 30 bombs, and he hit 20, and it was kind of like an underwhelming 20. I think that side of it comes back. And honestly, like, spring training stats don't really mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
If there's something over the years that has felt like it's meant something at times, the base stealing aggression, where he led all of spring training in stolen bases, he had 8 in spring. In 19 games. So I'm not saying he's going to be Esturi Ruiz, but if he can steal 25 bases in addition to a couple extra home runs, getting that OBP a little closer to 300, like, the floor is high enough that he only needs to be better at a couple little things. And then you talk to some of the swing people who have seen him in spring and think, like, yeah, he looks way more comfortable up there, the holes are minimized and things like that. I'm not going to go as far as chopping up the swing film and stuff, but I think you improve the plate discipline just a little bit, some of that power comes back, you increase the base running a little bit like he has in spring, and all of those little improvements, suddenly you're a league average hitter who plays elite defense. I think people will be much less mad at Dalton Varsho.
I don't know if people are gonna stay mad, maybe some always will, because again, he is a, like, I think he said avatar, right?
Yeah.
For the Shapiro Atkins, and some people are just out on that front office and they're pissed and they want to funnel their hatred. And so it's like, if the Varsho trade continues to not go well, that is like the main thing that you can just point to and say, well, these guys are failures because of this, right? And so I get it, and that's fine. I'm not bothered by fans that way. I will say this about the defense stuff. I feel like every time I take this position of I don't care about the defense, I'm not trying to minimize that I understand the impact that he has defensively or that he's one of the better players. My thought has just always been, I don't want to trade a premium asset, especially when you don't have a lot of them at a premium position who also plays great defense, when the hit tool isn't going to be there or it's not even going to be a plus. Like, what I want to see from Varsho is actually not a league average hitter. The marker for success for me in this trade, if you were to say win it, which looks harder and harder by the day.
I mean, Arizona's got 5 years of Gabriel Moreno
for
left.
Sure.
Yeah.
But for their standpoint, for me to really believe that they made a good trade, he actually needs to be not only the plus defender, but actually a plus hitter too.
Yeah.
And this is the thing for me why I still believe in the bat. 761 OPS on the road last year, 576 at home.
Crazy.
Like, I didn't look this up.
This is a ballpark that, look,
was supposed to play to him.
Yeah, there was some disagreement. Like Petriello and I ran our little simulations and came up to different results. Mine was very bare bones and like playing around on my computer. Petriello's was like, let's use MLB StatCast power. And like they disagreed. Like the Blue Jays thought it would play neutral. Petriello's numbers said it would play a little positive to hitters. Mine said they'd play a little negative to hitters. But what all those things agreed on was that lefty power alley should have been friendly to guys. And we didn't see that very much, but we really didn't see it for Dalton Varsho.
Okay. So that basically when we do the high end projections of Varsho, what do they say?
Around an 800 OPS.
Yeah,
and 27 bombs.
Because I was
that's not the 100. That's not the tippy. Yeah. This is 90th percentile. Because
I'll tell you that 90th percentile, you hit that, and everybody, even the Mies who ripped the trade, they're going to shut up. You hit 27 to 30 home runs, and you have a OPS that starts with an 8 with that defense. Everybody's going to love you.
Yeah,
all right?
I mean, you're going to be a 4.5 win player, probably.
Especially
five win
since you're going to have electric plays on the bases. He's a great base runner, and if he starts stealing bags, that's going to be.
He's my favorite kind of base runner, where like he is absolutely like he is not what you would call fast.
No,
but he's just like smart, good angles, good jump, good timing,
and he looks like a football player when he runs, which is what I really like about.
Yeah,
I want to love the Art and Bar show. I want to be there with
him.
He's
like Christian McCaffrey trying to steal base.
Yeah, that's it. I really like it. Okay, so the other guy, Alejandro Kirk, positive, negative, regression. He had a 692 OPS last year, down from 786, which you know is especially interesting because I feel like most people would agree that the process was still good. He didn't get on base.
He never swings at bad pitches.
Yeah.
But there's a part of the discussion last year was like. Even if you have a good eye, and Cavan dealt with this early in the year, if you have a really good eye and you lay off balls, but you can't do damage, it's hard to draw a walk when a pitcher's comfortable throwing you a lot of strikes. So this was the third season in a row. He's played three seasons in the majors where his walk and strikeout rate were basically identical. Mm-hmm. For his career, they're almost dead even. But walking 10 or 11% of the time and never striking out is not crazy valuable if a pitcher is comfortable, hey, with three balls, I can groove it down the middle, and you're going to hit 140 on pitches down the middle or whatever
or
it was.
Or if I put you on base, you're going to be one of the worst base runners in all baseball.
And hey, that bat-to-ball skill, that's really, really good. And Luis Arraez, like, hit, like, what, 360 or whatever last year, being a slower guy with bat-to-ball skill. Mm-hmm. But, like, most people in the league are not Luis Arraez who can just poke a line drive in between the second baseman and the right fielder over and over and over again. For most people, if you're going to be a bat to ball, put the ball in play guy, you have to have the ability to get from home to first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not there for him. And that's how like a guy who has probably the best plate discipline and best eye on the team ends up with like a 334 OBP, which is solid, but like not like the hit tool and plate discipline tool for this guy are that of like a 360, 370 OBP guy.
I was going to say, that's actually even more of like a frustrating thing for me with Kirk is that he is so good at, like that was the, if you're talking about the moments of the season where they had, what was it like two on, two out guys, to me, it's like he was one of the dudes of, how many guys had that exact count you're talking about? The 3-0, worked himself into a great count, and then it ended up being, you know, a soft flyout. Like something that,
oh, well, here's a fastball down the middle. Yeah, see what you can do with it.
He never did any damage on it. 8 home runs last year. I guess if we're doing the positive regression with Alejandro Kirk, it centers around that then is, do you think that he can add more power with that frame? Can he at least get closer to the 14 home runs that we saw, granted, in more games, more plate appearances in 2022?
I do. I think a little bit. Like, okay. I don't. This is a guy who, you know, in 2022, that OPS was close to 800, was 787. His 90th percentile projection has him well into the 800s, like 815, 820. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I see that. I don't know if we've seen the power consistently enough.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if his approach that is so contact and don't make an out oriented will let him unlock full power over a whole season, but I think like getting him back to a 760, 770 OPS type where he's that's a very good hitter for the catching position and a pretty solid hitter overall. Like I think he has that. The discipline and the hit tool are just like he has too good an approach to not be a solid hitter. I just at this point I like if he hit 15 home runs, I'd probably be like happily surprised.
Oh yeah. That'd be his career high. He had 14 in 2022 when he was an All-Star.
Yeah.
So yeah,
okay.
I'm taking the 15 every single day of the week.
Yeah.
Like if that happens for you, I actually think that you're back to All-Star Alejandro Kirk, because if you've got that bat to ball and all of a sudden you're putting that many out of the yard, you're an All-Star catcher again. Cause that was the thing with him is, and I'm glad he made strides with his defense because they were actually really significant and he deserves credit for them. But it's always, again, it's harder to give guys a lot of credit for that when they're projected or portrayed as significant offensive contributors. And then during an offensively down season, they're also not producing at the rate that we were first accustomed to.
And, you know, when it comes to like your point with Varsho's defense, for example, if he's not hitting at all, there are other guys who are good defensive outfielders, right? Like the replacement level is only difficult if you're doing all the things. Like Cam Eden, who was on the 40 man for a minute last year, like he is the best defensive outfielder in the system. If all you cared about was the outfield defense, well, you'd have him up.
Put him in.
Jeff Mathis would still be in the league if all we cared about was the catcher's defense. Like, I know Houston won a World Series playing Martin Maldonado every day, but that's kind of a joke.
And he's also clutch.
Yeah, he is. So, and here's another thing, and this is me turning my back on the nerds a little bit in my I'm a big catcher guy card a little bit.
All right.
I believe that these catching metrics that we have line up fairly well with the eye test. I believe that when you look at the leaderboards, like, yep, that makes sense. That guy feels like a good catcher. I watched that guy 10 times this year. That makes sense. And I know that there is stability in those. Like, they're good stats. The way we value, like, the total value that gets assigned to him, I think is a little high. So, like, Alejandro Kirk last year, his value only on the defensive side was the equivalent of, like, a top 40 hitter's offensive value. So you're telling me that the catcher defense alone, and he only started like 90-some-odd games. The catcher defense alone in 90-some-odd games was as valuable as, like, the second-best hitter and their offense in, like, a good offense. That to me, is a little extreme.
Yeah.
And, like, again, I love catchers, and I think these are good stats, but I tend to, like, when we look at Kirk's year last year, it's like, oh, he was almost a two-win player despite the hitting. I think maybe there's a little bit too much value
in the
catcher stuff.
I'll be more definitive than that. I don't think maybe. As a non-math guy, I would like to say very, like, sternly, that is wrong. This is, I don't want to go on a side tangent here. I want to stick to the segment, but this is one of the things that actually usually bothers me the most about the analytics community, is that when there is such a hard deviation like this, like when we start to get guys who game these systems, right? Like Kirk Cousins is great at it. Where every single year you look at the QBR stats, right? Or a lot of the analytics, and they tell you that Kirk Cousins is one of the better quarterbacks in the NFL. It's like,
just not on prime time.
Yeah, but it's like, yeah, we get it. He games the system on completed passes.
Right.
Find a way to adjust that model instead of year over year telling us that he's one of the best five guys in the NFL when there's not one person on planet Earth who would stake their life or reputation on Kirk Cousins in a meaningful football game. So, yeah, I don't know why they would continue to push that out there when there's just no way that can be true anyway.
Yeah, and look, some of this is just like, you got to adjust these stats over time, things like that. I just, this is, it's one of my most, like, not anti-analytics, but just, like, where I have a poor, and, like, obviously I'm about to start a season where I do 2 hours a day talking about the Jays and the numbers stuff comes up.
But that's why people like your show, though. And that's why people, I think, again, this is what the analytics community needs a little bit more of, is less of a dogmatic approach to certain things and more of a nuanced look at stuff, which is funny because that's sort of what a lot of those people wanted from the eye test community from the outset of this becoming a major advancement. Okay, so my last, can he be a big upside guy? Can there be a real positive regression? Actually, I don't even know if this should be like a positive regression because he was so good when he first arrived, but then I think the numbers sort of leveled out. Is Babe Schneider. Like, Ennis is extremely high on him. He looks at the minor league numbers and he says, what if this guy is one of the best second basemen in all of baseball, essentially? And then I hear from people down at spring and they go, well, actually, he's the dude that might get shuttled down to AAA first. And
I mean, it was possible if that Espinal trade didn't materialize,
that he was gone. Right.
Like, we don't care about spring stats, really, but when it comes to a prospect, like, he's not young for a prospect, but if it comes down to, say, Espinal was still on the roster and the question was, well, do you want Davis Schneider as a pinch hitter and starting against lefties, or do you want him getting every day at bats in AAA to continue to get better? He might have lost that argument.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
where
are you at with the ability to, I don't want to say replicate what we saw when he first came up, because that was outrageous. That was clearly
also the,
like,
only fun moment of the entire season.
Yeah, no, it was very much the Lynn Sanity of the Jays season, where it was a couple weeks of just extreme fun and people going, can this be sustainable? This can't possibly stay sustainable. But yeah, where are you at just in terms of his ability to provide surplus value?
Yeah, I mean, he makes the league minimum, right? So, like, the surplus value is pretty straightforward.
If he's a baseball player.
Yeah. And look, I think the time in left field is a bit of an adventure. He's okay at second base. There's going to be enough plate appearances for him against lefties as a pinch hitter and things like that. He's going to have a role on this team. Yep. And having that, like, if you look at the Jays benches from the last couple of years and you compare it to this year where you have Davis Schneider and, for the time being, Vogelbach off the bench, you have actual offensive threats off the bench is a really nice thing to have, right?
Real,
like,
power,
like,
off
whereas
the bench.
In that, like, Santiago Espinal pinch hit a bunch last year.
Mm-hmm.
That sucks. And now you're going to have, you know, David Schneider against tough lefties, Daniel Vogelbach against tough righties. Like that's anyway, it's an improvement. His path to being an everyday guy is he would have to be significantly better than Isaiah Kiner-Falefa at the plate because the defensive gap is so big, or he's got to outplay Cavan, which Cavan has the slight benefit of being on the stronger side of a platoon, right? Mm-hmm. Like even if those guys went straight platoon, Cavan would get about 2/3 of the starts. So that's his challenge there. In terms of the skill set, the power is real. Mm-hmm. There's not really much question about that. He's a guy who, again, a lot of the AAA guys coming up have had the one thing the org has done a really, really good job on is this swing decision stuff of laying off stuff you can't do damage on. Mm-hmm. And it's why one of the challenges for David Schneider when he came up and there was a book on him was that high fastball.
Yeah.
Because in AAA, just lay off of it. The pitchers down there can't pinpoint locate that as much. The automatic ball strike system was a little bit favorable to short guys at the top of the zone is what the data says.
Nice short kings.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah. Like you might've heard the name Rafael Lantigua during spring training, like a bunch
suck
of
it, Michael. Yeah. You're never playing minor league baseball, buddy.
Like Lantigua was even shorter than Schneider. And a couple of the AAA guys joked to me last year, like this guy's never taken a walk in his whole career. We get the automatic ball strike system and suddenly he's Joey Votto with the plate discipline.
Finally short guys in professional sports getting an advantage.
Yeah. Now in terms of him, like doing enough to beat out Biggio for an everyday spot and, you know, just carve out more playing time. Like he's got to correct some of the holes in the swing. Like he's not going to be, he doesn't profile right now as like a high contact, high average guy. There's going to be a lot of swing and miss there, which is fine if you're belting the bombs. And he does take a good number of walks. I think I like the person and the player a lot, but I think for this year...
Yeah, don't play politics. We know you've been at pitch talks with him and you've chummed around.
Yeah,
in the
dugouts. I just think the more reasonable expectation for this year is like he's a really solid bench piece slash start.
Wait, did you want to say plebe? You're like,
he's a bench plebe. like start two games a week and be a really valuable bench piece. There are enough question marks beyond the raw power in terms of, you know, how elite pitchers are going to be able to exploit him, you know, high in the zone with elite velocity. Mm-hmm. I have some question marks there. I think he's like a good bench player, but even like the not to live and die by the projection systems, but even those ones, like they see him being like a little above average at the plate. Mm-hmm. And part of that is just like all of these things, when you only have 35 games of major league sample, they're all going to be like regress. Yep. Like he'll come back down to earth.
Well, yeah, he had 35 games and he hit 12. What was it? No, sorry, 8 bombs.
8 bombs. Yeah. And like 20 ribbies. And like, he was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I could see a scenario where his role this year is more like it was at the end of last year, which was you're going to get one or two starts a week. And it's going to be a little frustrating because you might get that one start in a week, hit a home run, and people will be like, why aren't you in the lineup? You know, also some of this could be like I didn't get to see him a ton at second base during spring. Mm-hmm. If he's improved there, that changes the conversation a little bit too. I think he's going to start in left field against lefties because you have Varsho and Kiermaier who you're going to want to get days off, and you might not want to play both of them against lefties. It's basically him, Cavan, Clemente, and IKF competing for the second base and third base slots. Yeah. And I think he's either going to have to tear the cover off the ball or have shown real growth as a defensive second baseman and nobody talked about that at spring, so I'm assuming it hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm going to summarize the upside guys or the guys that I listed as the big potential upside guys, it feels like you have Vlad as likely big potential upside.
Yeah, not 2021 upside, but he's going to be better than the last 2 years.
Yeah, we did that. Yeah. But I'm just saying this is the easy way to mark it down.
Yeah.
Right? You have Vlad as likely big potential upside. Varsho has likely big potential upside. Kirk has upside, but not as big as we would be sort of thinking, especially based on when he first broke in and it looked like this was a generational offensive catcher. Yeah. And then David Schneider, probably more likely to be not, looking at an upside, real impact player on this roster.
Right.
Okay. So have we hit all the guys that you think I should have outlined as big positive regression or big positive regression guys, or is there someone else that I missed that you think actually has a lot more to give offensively, not from a war standpoint, not defensively, just like offensive actually adds to this group in a more significant way?
No, other than that, I think like Ernie Clement is like a legitimately helpful piece, yeah. and more of that value comes on the offensive side. Like, I know there's the defensive versatility, but he can hit.
Yeah, he can hit.
And that's, you know, that's not regression, though. That's just we haven't seen the guy yet.
Yeah. Because, my only other guy was going to be IKF.
Yeah.
Yeah, because this stuff bothers me is, I'm bringing you these numbers. So he had an OPS plus of 78 last season. Chapman's was 108. And I know Chapman, everyone was like, well, his beginning was so good. And so everyone looks at Chapman as who cares that he left. But over the last three seasons, IKF has an OPS plus of 83 compared to Chapman's 108.
He's never been league average at the plate. Yeah. Like, not even particularly. Yeah. Like, what's his highest OPS plus, 90?
And their careers, IKF is 81 compared to 117 for Chapman. It's just the thing that I think bothers me actually the most about it is that Chapman's a better glove man.
Yeah, like Kiner Falefa is like the best defensive third baseman on the roster now, and like has played shortstop and center field and things like he's a good defender, but he's not the defender Matt Chapman is, and he's not in the same world as a hitter. And I know they like the contact profile and stuff, and I think they probably see some stuff that they could like fix and get more out of his swing. Yeah. But I don't know, when everyone else in IKF's tier of the free agent market got like $2 to $3 million and you gave them 2 years, 15 mil. And also like maybe none of your prospects are ready, but they're all kind of like multi-position infield types. I don't know. I'm not going to get there with that deal.
Okay. Let's take a quick break and then let's get into the, can they just stay the same or are they going to negatively regress? There's three guys I have next.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, Blake Murphy's still here. Now it's time to do the dirty business.
Bury some guys.
Well, I'm actually kind of hoping that it's more optimistic than I said. Because, again, if we're summarizing, it was Vladdy, likely some big potential. We've got two guys in the likely big upside offensively this season, and that's Vladdy and Varsho. Then we have one guy who is in the minimal but still positive regression, which is Kirk. That one guy who's likely to regress technically because I think his OPS was, 1,000. Yeah, it was incredible last year. But in terms of adding surplus value offensively, Davis Schneider, we think that it's more unlikely that that ends up happening. Okay, so now there's three guys, three vets, three older dudes that I wanted to go over in terms of potential negative regression. And that is George Springer, Justin Turner. And then lastly, because it just feels almost painful to do this, but they actually got a lot from Kevin Kiermaier last year, like he was a 741 OPS guy. So I'm going to start with him. He ended up hitting 8 bombs. It's like his best offensive season for a long time. Like just to put it in perspective for him, these were his OPS seasons before that. 649, 716, 683, 676, 653, right? 741 in his age 33 season. I guess the question here is how significant do you think this drop off is going to be? Because it looks like it could actually be a lot for a guy that had 408 plate appearances for this team last year.
Yeah, so Kiermaier and Springer back-to-back here are interesting because both of them were in their age 33 season last year.
One guy went up, one guy went down.
And the projection systems have them going in different directions this year. They have Kiermaier going down and Springer coming back up, which is interesting because usually when you're into your early to mid-30s, these projection systems, and it's not universal, but basically once you start to decline, they throw up a red flag.
Yeah.
They're like, guys don't often get it back. Maybe it was an injury thing, but like the system can only see guy in his 30s started getting worse. Now, in Kiermaier's case, I'm not all that surprised that it's not buying that he's suddenly a better hitter in his 30s. I would understand, like, there was the hip stuff. Mm-hmm. There was the, you know, maybe just the comfort level, whatever. He spoke very highly about his fit and things like that. The average, like, the baseline projection for him has him at a 664 OPS. So that's a pretty good drop-off from 741 last year. That would still make him a pretty valuable piece because he's, you know, the best defensive center fielder in baseball. Sure. Most of his career with Tampa Bay, he was in the kind of 80 to 90 range. Like the last 5 years before he came to Toronto, four of those years, he was in the 80 to 95 range in terms of OPS plus. Only one of those years was he an average hitter. When he was an average hitter, it was early in his career, like his early to mid 20s. So you can be a very good version of Kevin Kiermaier and not hit particularly well. That's probably where I'd place the bet. When you dig in under the surface and try to see, you know, why was he better last year. There's not a ton there. He cut the strikeout rate, which is really nice. He said coming into the year, he had told Ben Wagner this, that he wanted to lead the league in hits from the nine hole. He ended up doing that, but he started coming up higher in the batting order. But that to me, like, even though that was a little jokey, that to me was like, okay, maybe this is a more contact oriented approach. Maybe that suits a guy like that at that age. And we did see it was the lowest strikeout rate he had since he was 25. Mm. So that part of it's maybe real, but yeah, the overall package suddenly being an above average hitter, I'm going to trust the longer track record here that he's going to come back down offensive. Still a very valuable player. I'd also just like between the bat maybe coming down a little bit and age and stuff like that, like 129 games was the second most he'd ever played in a season.
Yeah.
I'm going to probably take the slight under on that too.
Yeah. I don't think the plan was ever for him to play that many games in the first place. No. And the plan this year is probably like, listen, if he ends up with that many plate appearances again, 408, then to me, that's actually indicating that your offense once again was really not in a great place and you were leaning on him too heavily. Okay. So George Springer, 102 OPS plus last year. I think the more significant stuff that I sort of want to ask you about, because maybe I should have put him in positive regression because that seems so low for a guy who's over his 10-year career has a 128 OPS plus.
But he's 34.
Yeah, but that's the thing is I'm kind of hoping that it's a, I guess, positive regression in the season, but that you look at some of, and again, I don't understand all of these things nearly as well as you do, but in reading a lot of the metrics with his stuff, it wasn't like this guy was unlucky last year. It's that he's showing a lot of signs of decline.
So yeah, early in the season, there was a little bit of he's getting unfortunate. He's having some bad ball luck. And then it hit a point where it seemed like he changed his approach. He got more aggressive early in counts. There was a little bit of success with that. Mm-hmm. But what trailed from that was a guy who's always been a very high walk guy wasn't taking as many walks, which can be fine in general, but he's your leadoff hitter, right? Like his approach last year was more like a five hitter where he's going to be aggressive early in counts. You're maybe selling out for the power or looking for the power early a little bit more, not working as deep into counts. That can be fine. But over the course of the season, what we then saw was he was getting challenged more early in counts. And if you look at the whole season, the biggest, and this is, it's going to be fascinating to me because the projection systems are optimistic about him. So he had what last year, 732 OPS. Mm-hmm. His baseline is like 780 and his upside outcome is like 815, 820. So they see him bouncing back to like potentially as good as 2022 when he had like an 820. When you look under the hood into his struggles last year, and I just laid out the sequencing, but like the whole season picture, the red flag is that he really struggled with the heater. Mm-hmm. And when you're 34, last year was the healthiest he's ever been in his whole career, other than I think one year in Houston where he played every single game. Mm-hmm. He didn't have the nagging stuff. He was playing in right field full time. Like none of the normal Springer caveats applied. He really struggled with fastballs. And I don't like, we've seen really elite hitters. Jose Bautista went through this at kind of the tail end of his career. He couldn't catch up to elite velocity. He had to start cheating fastballs early, and that took away some of that elite plate discipline, and the strikeout rate came up, the walk rate came down. You kind of became more of an all-or-nothing home run hitter. Josh Donaldson went through that with the Yankees. When it was Aaron Judge watch and Donaldson was here for those series, I was very locked in on those games from good seats, and Josh Donaldson was jumping to get ahead of fastballs very, very early. And it created these big holes in his swings. And he just like, he hasn't been able to put it all together since. I'm not saying it's that bad with Springer. He wasn't the worst hitter in baseball against fastballs. Mm-hmm. But if there's something keeping me from being too optimistic about certainly the 815, 820 OPS bounce back, I think the, 775-ish is completely reasonable to expect from him, given some of the misfortune last year and things like that. But the trouble with the fastball, like I'm going to need to see him do well against high-end velocity early on here before I get like too confident that he's got even 2022 level George Springer back.
Yeah, and I will say, just in, if you're trying to spin it a little positive here, is Bautista in 2017 when he really dropped off, he was 37. Yeah. Josh Donaldson with the Yankees first season when he started to really drop off was 36. Yeah. So both those guys were a little bit older than Springer is right now. This is I need a fast one here. Because we're going to do two quick rapid fire ones. So one of my big theories with the Warriors too is that they're aging really fast because they've also had a ton of miles on the tires when it comes to the playoffs, right? Like they've added a season.
Playing.
Yeah, is there something to that with baseball players too, though? Like Springer played a lot of playoff games with the Astros. He's got those extra miles on the tires. Is there anything to indicate that? Because baseball, you would kind of think, no, the more you play, the better you are. You know, like you're just getting more reps.
Yeah.
Not wearing down as much.
I think in baseball, because you can move guys to lesser positions.
Like is he an older 34?
You can slow it. Yes, he is an older 34. And that's in part because of the playoff runs and in part because he played center field, which is a premium position for so long. But in baseball, you have the option, like Steph Curry can't get off the ball or play 25 minutes. You're just not going to do that. In baseball, you can at least move a guy to a lesser position. And that's part of the concern with Kiermaier too, right? Is like, he doesn't have the miles from games played in deep playoff runs and stuff, but he has a lot of injury red tape. So you wonder, you know, is that an old 33? Is it an old 34? Springer's probably on that end, but the ability to move him off of center to right field probably slows that a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, you know who's an old, I would say 39?
the oldest player on an active roster
Justin
today?
Justin Turner. Yeah. Again, we'll try to keep this one shorter, but yeah, you look at the OPS last year was a slight uptick from the season before in his age 38 season, but it was also playing at Fenway, and his OPS plus actually still did drop. What do you think Justin Turner provides you? Is he going to be able to just maintain that level of an 800 OPS, 114 OPS plus?
Yeah, I mean, the baseline projection would say no. It has him more at like 750, 760, but that is also like those systems are not going to trust anyone who's 39 years old. Mm-hmm. He still has a good high percentile outcome where, you know, that's, we're talking like an 820 in the 90th percentile outcome, which the Jays would absolutely take on this year that he signed. I think they're going to not play him every day the way Boston needed to. Like he's going to be in there a lot, but 146 games is probably not the plan for a 39-year-old. I think if he could run back next year, you're really happy with that. Maybe not even the 23 homers, but the ability, like he has a good on-base ability as well. I think my guess here would be he's really solid. Maybe I think he could repeat last year. 115 OPS plus. I think he has enough just raw offensive talent to repeat that. I don't know if he sticks in the heart of the order where they have him the whole season and what that looks like if he only plays like 130 games maybe. Mm-hmm. But I think he could run back next year. There's enough raw power there and he has such a good approach that I could see 115 OPS plus again.
I hope so because I really do think that if you're talking about fan favorite potential, that he's the highest upside.
This fan base having to come around on a guy who played on the evil Dodgers empire and the Red Sox.
No, but you know how great it would be is if the Dodgers gave up on what should have been a Dodger great and he ends up closing his career with the Jays and he's great and then Shohei embroiled in his controversy falls apart.
Yeah. Like, if this fan base can come around on Kevin Kiermaier, the stealer of Blue Jays home runs for a decade, you can come around on 1 year. You can wash off 1 year of Red Sox stink.
I think that there's only one guy that they couldn't have turned around on in the last decade. And he happens to be the guy that punched Jose Bautista in the face. And that's it.
Who also walked away from his Korean team the other day because they tried to send him to the minors. Mm. In Korea, he was getting sent to the minors and he bailed on his team.
Yeah, that's a tough look. That's a tough way to close a career. Blake Murphy, you're on again in an hour. Thanks so much for making time. See you, buddy. This is not the music I need for this quote. Instead of having a strong period and building on it and continuing to do the things that we had done well, I thought we just overdid it. It was just really immature. Immature from our most our most inexperienced players and our leaders. That was Sheldon Keefe on last night's Leafs game. Luke Fox was there. He's our senior writer for Sportsnet. What's up, brother? How are we doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Keith goes. Go ahead.
Before we start, I just want to give you a shout out for your Leafs talk. I've had a few Leaf fan friends of mine. Mm-hmm. How much they love the show you and Sammy are doing. So congratulations on the success there.
Yeah, it's honestly just proof of where content is going, which is if you just do a lot of it and you're consistent, you'll you'll get viewers. It doesn't have to be good. You know, just keep putting it out there, and people will be like, I guess this is here, so we'll do it. We'll watch it. We'll like it. It's really a testament to that more than it is anything we're doing well. But yes, thank you for that. Thank you for that, buddy. So yeah, I was going to say, Keefe goes in on these guys. He's not afraid to do it, but I was thinking, you know, he's trying to put it out there right now about this stretch and how they're back in this position where the final regular season games are kind of meaningless. And I want to get into sort of load management stuff with you and what to read into some of these injuries or the way that they're going to deploy players. But yeah, it really does feel as though the mantra from him and the coaching staff is they really, really, really don't want these guys to slip into bad habits heading into the postseason. Is that your read on all this?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, Keefe keeps using words like urgency, and you know, they're trying to dial it up, and you know, because there's this theory, and I think there's a lot to it, that you can't just flip a switch and start playing playoff hockey. I think you have to be dialed in. Many players and coaches will tell you that, and they've had a few games like this one. There's one in Philly too where they don't have it. And I think what's frustrating Sheldon Keefe, and he kind of, you know, let it boil over in his post-game remarks last night, is the same guys that can go out and put a really strong, physical, dominant performance against the Edmonton Oilers on Saturday night can kind of lay an egg and have two leads slip away. And yeah, Jake Allen was good, but defensively they were a mess, and they're cheating for offense and some kind of boneheaded passes. They had 19 giveaways, and he knows that type of performance will get you burned in the playoffs. I mean, he got them burned in the regular season against a pretty mediocre Devils squad. So imagine when they're playing a real opponent, and I think it's frustrating him. And I think one of the things at play here is he has no security. Yeah, he has a contract extension, but if this thing doesn't work, it's probably hit. Whereas the leaders that he called out and mentioned, you know, Tavares, Nylander, Austin, like, they're all going to be fine. So I think maybe the coach is feeling it more than the players. And I think sometimes the players are a little bit lackadaisical and thinking, hey, yeah, we had a stinker, but there's 82 of these. We're not going anywhere in the standings. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we can, we'll turn it on. We know what we're capable of. That's not really us. And Sheldon Keefe's worried, like, yeah, but a few of those and the bad habits creep in and we're done fast.
Yeah. I would have such a hard time not taking that personally if I was Sheldon Keefe, right? Because you make plays like the Domi play last night, right? And you lose these games that way. And it's your ass as a coach. It's your reputation as a coach. And these guys end up, you know, just being fine. They're all going to end up making their money. They're all going to end up still playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And so hopefully for him, it doesn't become that way. Hopefully for him, he is able to still compartmentalize that so that the message does continue to get through. Because I think that that's like all walks of life, which is when someone gets emotional and it starts to feel personal, it's harder to deliver a message. Like, I've felt that as a leader. I'm sure you have as well, you know. But yeah, I think that the stuff that he's talking about, though, specifically the lack of attention to detail stuff, that's been something that's haunted the Leafs year over year. I think that they can turn it up. I think that those players are right in terms of they've played well enough in the postseasons despite the lack of actual success that they would say, yeah, no, we can ramp up the intensity. We can do these things. But if you look back on all these playoff runs, something has remained consistent, which is these boneheaded mistakes, these bad turnovers, the lack of attention to detail. This has cost them in multiple series that have gone to seven games. And so if you're him and you're looking at this, I think you kind of want that part of it sharpened up. You want them to basically acknowledge to you that there's no more just being completely careless with the puck and flipping it to other teams and, you know, helping them break out, giving them high danger opportunities and saying this is going to be the focus even when there is not a lot of at stake, because that's the thing you want to have going into the playoffs. Maybe that's the most important thing that you can drill down that can actually have an impact on your success in a couple of, weeks now.
Yeah. It's like, if you're the coach, what are you trying to solve here? Or what are you trying to figure out in these last, now there's 11 games left and you're not catching Boston or Florida. Maybe there's an outside chance they get caught by Tampa. They're four games up, and they do have two games head-to-head against the Lightning down the stretch. So if Tampa wins both of them, maybe you could see a world. But they're pretty dug in where they are. So what do you got to figure out if you're the coach? One, I think number one in his mind is we got to make sure our habits are better. We got to clean up our special teams. Like, the power play didn't score again last night. Penalty kill did go 2-for-2. So that's a positive, because it's been a disaster basically all of March, especially with Marner and Yarncroc out. But the power play needs to sharpen up. So they're trying to get their special teams in order. They're trying to figure out what the heck their D pairs are going to be. Like, looking at, and granted, Morgan Rielly hurt, Joel Edmondson hurt, right? So you got to, you know, assume those guys are going to be in game one. But what, I don't think there was one of the three D pairs that, if I'm a Leaf fan, I would feel comfortable with having out there in a playoff series against a legit team. Like, all three D pairs had their flaws last night. There was no confidence there. So you got to figure out your D pairs. You got to figure out your forward lines. There's still, like, a lot of stuff to get your house in order before you go into Boston or go into Sunrise. And those will be hostile environments. Those are nasty teams. So you better be sharp.
Yeah. That's the one thing that does bother me about the not having home ice advantage stuff is, one, we actually do have data to suggest that it still does matter. I know that it matters way less than it used to, but it does. We have conclusive proof that the home teams win more games. And yes, part of that is because it's the better team. But also, yeah, you would have liked to have that. But for a Leafs group that does feel like they're going to struggle with finding some matchups, especially defensively, you would have thought that, man, they would really, really, really want to have a year where they could go into it and have home ice. I think that, to me, actually, it sort of does feel like they're going to have their blue line pairings. The penalty kill stuff, I think, is the most concerning part of the team. But then, yes, the shoring up of the mistakes and getting that attention to detail down the stretch, I do think is going to be important for them. And I think it's going to be also a fair thing to point to if it ends up burning them, which is, you're going to say it's because these guys didn't take it seriously. It's because they built up the bad habits. Same thing with, you know what it reminds me of? It's Jay's season. Look what happened to them last year. They lost in the postseason, and there was a huge spot in one of their playoff games where they had bad base running, where they made bad decisions on the base paths. You know where that materialized? All season long, we kept seeing them making bad decisions on the base paths, and then, of course, they end up making one in the playoffs. So, yeah, if that's the Leafs, that's the story that I'd be trying to caution against. Okay, so they are banged up, and you said it. They probably didn't play any of the pairings last night. But how much of what we're seeing with Edmondson and Rielly specifically, and, yeah, what we might end up seeing moving forward here is some kind of form of load management versus reasons to be concerned?
Yeah, I think there's some load management
to
play. I think, and same with Mitch Marner, you know, I think he probably would have played if these were playoff games. I think if you have the luxury of, you know, I know that you don't have the asterisks yet. You haven't officially secured your playoff spot, but you're pretty comfortable. You're winning enough games to keep your head above water. And I think that's afforded you the luxury of giving guys extra rest. Hey, let's healthy scratch TJ Brody, give him a mental reset, even though he's healthy, because we have time. So they are trying to use that as best they could. You know, Morgan Rielly was going to be a game-time decision, and it's like, what's the point? If he's not feeling 100%, of course give him the night off. It's a Tuesday against New Jersey, and you know, whether you get 0, 1, or 2 points, it probably isn't going to matter. There is probably some benefit, you would like to think, in having guys lower down the lineup get a few more games where they play a ton of minutes. You know, get the Benoits and Timmins, who you may not use in case of injury, get them playing some games. Like, all this experience could help down the road. So, if you have top-line guys that are banged up, give them a little extra rest. I absolutely think there's a load management thing at play, and that is one of the there's pros and cons to their comfort in the standings, and that's one of the benefits, is they can do a little bit of that.
Yeah, that's what I was saying last night, is, you know, you've got a pretty crazy schedule down the stretch here. When April rolls over, it's just you play every night. I think they've got 9 games between April 1st and the 17th. Like, it's a lot. So the fact that you aren't chasing a spot or trying to chase a team in the standings and having a burnout maybe that ends up working out for you. I know some people believe, like, you know, you're playing in, then you just basically roll into playoffs. That could be a good thing too. But yeah, at least from a health standpoint, you're hoping guys are feeling rested, because that is absolutely not going to be an excuse for these guys. Is, oh, well, we were burnt out from the regular season. It's like, you had it maybe better than any other team. Okay, but when it comes to the injury stuff, it makes sense for the Riley thing, right? It makes sense for the Marner thing. Even Edmondson, who has struggled with injuries in his career, and very physical player, older player, bigger player. So yeah, who cares? Let him sit for a week. That's great. What do you read on the Samsonov injury stuff? Because this is twice he's left. One was a practice, but one was a game. Like, he's left the ice. And from the video standpoint, you go, is his career over? And then the coach says he's fine. And the coach didn't even really try to protect him, saying, oh, it was a scare or it was a pull. It's just, it was fine. You know, it almost felt like Sheldon Keefe was basically messaging it as, suck it up and stop doing this. What is your read on what has been happening with Samsonov? And yeah, you're around it. You've had a good read on him all year. What is this?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think Sheldon's frustration is, it goes
real.
Back a long way. It's real, but I think it goes back a long way with goalies in particular, right? Uh-huh. Like, I think about Freddie Anderson, and yeah, just like, no patience. Are you healthy? Oof. Or are you not healthy?
Yes.
Now with Samsonov, the one that happened in practice, that was a puck that caught him in a sensitive area. Mm. So I think that,
fine,
I wouldn't lump that into the same as him stretching out, trying to make a save, and it looked like he pulled something. I mean, it looked like a groin, maybe. I don't know. Uh-huh. But you're right. He has a habit, a tradition of, you know, being slow to get up sometimes, mm-hmm, even when he stays in the game. Sometimes it looks more dramatic than it is. And I'm sure Sheldon has noticed that as well, and probably is losing a bit of patience with it. But, you know, I'll take them at their word, and that it's a minor injury and he could be back practicing as early as today. But I think it just, I wonder what the mental effect that is, not just for the coaches, but also for Samsonov's teammates. Like, if he's in the net in game one, are they thinking, oh, well, the slightest stretch and this guy could be out, and then we got a goalie going in cold? Like, I wonder if it has an effect on the teammates, because he does have a pattern of this.
I can tell you that it had an effect on me yesterday when McKee brought it up in Leafs Talk, that potential of them being in a playoff game, and he does that, and then you're bringing in the goalie cold. I went, oof, I don't like that scenario. I think in all sports, nobody likes embellishers. I think in all of life, it's the same thing. When you have someone who's like, oh, I'm sick again, you're like, really? You're sick again? You know, like, okay, fine. I guess so. Yeah, no, take the day off. Yeah, all right. Fine. I don't like it. I don't like that the coach is speaking that way. And yeah, okay, so from the sounds of things, when you're like, okay, he could practice today, it's actually kind of an interesting spot for him psychologically, because he left. I thought he played incredibly well in that game against Edmonton. Like, he was sharp. He looked awesome. But then it starts to be a meltdown and he leaves the net. And now I'm getting almost conspiratorial, where I say, did he leave because he was afraid of being with the meltdown? Like, was there at least a fraction of that? Is that part of the reason why Keefe is pissed? And now he's facing a team, or potentially facing a team, where he's admitted to having nerves playing Washington. Washington's fighting, scratching, clawing for a playoff spot. You have your coach calling you out. You've got your former team. You've got red hot Ovechkin. But yet then you've got a goalie, Wohl, who's coming off of, I would say, maybe his worst game as a Toronto Maple Leaf. Where do you think they want to go with the starter on Thursday? Because it to me is actually kind of an interesting spot. If they're both healthy.
Yeah. If they're both healthy, I think they go Samsonov, just because they hadn't given Wohl two in a row. That was his first time getting two in a row.
Yeah.
Since he returned from injury. And you're right. Statistically, I looked it up. That was his worst performance as NHLer. His first time having a sub 800 save percentage, and you know he wasn't great. I mean, a lot of those were pretty high danger. I mean, they're giving Jack Hughes breakaways and like a lot of rush chances and high quality. But yeah, he wasn't on his game. And I do think, you know, that their plan is to balance it out. That was the plan before Samsonov tweaked whatever it was to pretty much split the last dozen games, 6-6. So I would bet if he's healthy, I bet Samsonov goes. Mm-hmm. The one thing I think is it's a little bit, I know he has admitted in the past he gets some butterflies going against his old team. Mm-hmm. But I think the one thing is this is at home. And I think it's a little bit different when you're walking into the building and seeing all those familiar faces. And part of me is kind of like, who cares if it's a little nerve-wracking? Like, the playoffs are nerve-wracking. Get over it.
Yeah,
you have to push through that stuff.
That's the good spin zone, is that this is an actual meaningful rep for him. Hey, you be nervous. Get playoff nervous. Face your old team. Make some saves. I'm not, like, where I'm at with the Wool game is it's not overly concerning. Like, I don't think it's some real mark of even the next couple of weeks. But, yeah, as a reminder that he is a young goaltender and there isn't a large sample that we're working off of here, you know? It's just that you can have your worst game as a Leaf conclusively on a, you know, Tuesday night against the New Jersey Devils in your first full season with the team. Anyways, okay, let's get Samsonov in there then hopefully Thursday and then maybe he works that stuff out. Two more. One more is on future. One's on health and the other one's on contract stuff, which is always fun. You reported Giordano. He's, you know, ready to go. He's back. Are we going to see him, though? Because they do have a lot of blue liners. It feels like he's, like, where would you even put him in terms of, if the playoffs start tomorrow, where is Mark Giordano in terms of the number he is on the blue line? Is it even 8?
Oh, yeah, I would say so.
That's the number, though, 8?
I would say 8. I have him ahead of Timmins.
Okay.
And I know Timmins is a righty, but watching Connor Timmins last night, just the simple things like trying to make a cute play in the neutral zone instead of just getting the puck deep. You know, he looked, I think he had a rough night. I think that pairing had a rough night. I don't think you ever want to see Benoit and Timmins together on the same pair.
Well, Keefe seems out on Benoit too, by the way. Like he's like publicly shaming him every opportunity. It seems.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'd have him 7 and Gio. And I think, you know, there's a bit of, Sheldon kind of, suggested that some things have to happen above his in terms of officially taking Gio off LTIR and then you have to move a body to create the cap room. I mean, his cap hit is small, but there are things you have to do. So he's like, that's beyond me. But medically, he's good to go. He's recovered from his concussion. He's been practicing regularly. This is a guy who likes to play all the time. Oldest guy in the league. Let's get him in a few games so he's not coming in really cold if and when they need him. Because, I mean, the whole thing is you hope it's a deep playoff run. Then play. Mark Giordano's going to play. Like, you're going to need guys. It's a rough game, especially the teams you're playing. Like, there's going to be guys that get banged up. So I'd like to see him get in a few games just because it's been so long now since he's played.
Yeah, I'd like to see him get in too. But I also feel like if he's getting in a playoff series that it's because you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I don't know what a 40-year-old Gio looks like in a playoff series after not playing for a month and only getting up a couple of games. Maybe it's good. Maybe the rest and recovery is good for him and he can find a little bit of fountain of youth for that stretch. One of my favorite players the last decade, one of my favorite Leafs for sure. But I'm a little nervous about how it looks. And I would imagine, given the sacrifices he's made and every single thing that I've heard about the guy, that he's not going to take sitting. Like, I don't think he's going to make any disruptions, but I don't think he's going to be thrilled. You know, like, I don't think that's his MO. It's the Luke Shen thing from a year ago where people said, yeah, if he's in the press box, he'll be totally fine. He'll feel no issues anyways about it. I think maybe Giordano would. Last one. I tweeted this yesterday. I think I'm off. Bertuzzi scores that first goal. And I know it's too early for contract stuff because I added the caveat of so much does depend on this playoff run, and especially for a guy like Bertuzzi, because if he puts together two straight playoffs where he's dominant in the games that mean the most, then we just know how this league thinks and we know how they react, and it's going to up the contract value. Like, there's just no doubt in my mind about it that if the Leafs go to the second and third round and Bertuzzi's one of their highest scorers, yeah, he's getting paid. But right now, do you have any feel about what the future could look like for him? Because what I'm getting back is that this was a pure mercenary play and that it's very unlikely he's a Leaf moving forward. But two is, So give me that part. But then two is, what do you think the contract would look like today that both parties would sign? If it was on the table and you could be the arbiter, what would that look like to you?
Ooh.
Because I've been getting so many different answers.
Yeah, it is a tricky one.
Real tricky.
His consistency has been horrible, but he's heating up of late. And the whole reason to bring him in is because he's supposed to be the kind of guy whose game elevates in the playoffs. And it did in the one series he played with Boston. And they ended up losing that series. So it was a pretty small sample size. So I honestly think that there's going to be no decisions on him or anyone else. They're going to let this thing play out and see how he actually performs in the playoffs. But, you know, I would take a look at it. I'd be hesitant to give him term because of A, the inconsistency, and B, he's been remarkably healthy by Bertuzzi's standards this year. And he has a history of back issues. So if I'm the Leafs, I'm not giving him much term. I wouldn't give him more than 3 years. But if he has a great playoffs, there's probably a team that will.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm guessing, you know, if I were to put a number, I'd probably say there's an 80% chance he prices himself out of town.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is kind of the reconciliation that came to yesterday. And again, they got bigger fish to fry, but this is just what I was thinking about. And this is my show, so I'm doing it. I couldn't help but think, like, okay, right, this guy, he's heating up. The fans are starting to love him. He's becoming more of a fan favorite because he's delivering on the player that we thought he was going to be. And he's showcasing, like, so much of the regular season is just a test for the playoffs, right? And now we're actually seeing with the 4 goals in 6 games and now up to 16 goals and the way that he's interacting with his teammates and the way the media is receiving him, the fan base is receiving him. You're going, oh, okay, yeah, we're getting an idea of what a good playoffs could look like for Bertuzzi. We're getting a good idea of what this guy could be. But, yeah, the contract, I'm with you. I don't think that you can give him 5 years if you're the Leafs. It would have to be a short-term one. But if you're doing short-term again, like if you were trying to say 3 years, I think the number kind of has to be uncomfortable because you look at the free agents this year, and it's not deep at left wing. Gensel is going to go back to as a winger, he's going to go back to Carolina. You would assume he's going to get a big contract there, that they're going to pay him. They didn't make that move without that idea. And then it looks like Bertuzzi's at the top of the list, especially if, again, playoff performance. So if you're the Leafs, are you going to give him $6 million per year over a 3-year contract when he's getting 40 points? Like, it's tough. It's a really, really tricky contract. And so, yeah, the more I thought about it, the more I was like, damn, this really is going to be a 1-year mercenary rental. Enjoy it while you have it, because it's hard to envision him being in the blue and white for a extended stretch.
Yeah, and I know they're a little soft on the left side in particular, but if you're making a big free agent play, is it forward? Like, is it Bertuzzi?
Yes, there's one guy, like, for sure.
Or is it the back end? Like,
both.
They have Jake McCabe and Morgan Riley signed for next year on defense. They need defense more than they need secondary scoring winger, in my mind.
Yeah. No,
I mean, that's not a knock on Bertuzzi. I like what he's brought, especially lately. I just don't know if the finances are going to work to keep him here.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. It can't be winger, but to me, it's you've got two spots. One is you really need to use everything to shore up your blue line, and I think that's where you're pushing in trade assets too. But yeah, I started texting with like 5 different people last night because I was looking at the free agents. Chandler Stephenson has to be their guy. Like, that's got to be trying to get a center, trying to get somebody like that who, can be a... Because that's the problem I see with the team right now outside of the blue line is, God, they would just kill to be able to put Tavares as 3C surrounded by maybe Nyes McMahon or Yarncroc McMahon. Probably Yarncroc McMahon. And then spread out the scoring over 3 lines. But they just can't do it because they don't have another centerman. You know? Like, there's no one else. Dewar, Kampf, Domi, every one of those ideas is an uncomfortable fit in an elevated role. And so you just have to do kind of what they did last night.
And with the hurdle trade, I liked your idea with Stephenson, because with the hurdle trade, it's almost like they're pairing for him to walk out the door and get his money elsewhere.
Yeah. So give him money. That would be the guy. Luke Fox, senior writer for Sportsnet. Thanks for being generous with the time, buddy. I appreciate it.
Okay. Have a good one.
See you, pal. Luke Fox. Yeah, I got a ton of tweets yesterday about the Bertuzzi contract. And the way I landed was, if it was today, would you do 3 years at $6 million per? And I know people balk at that and they're like, how could you pay that much money? He's getting $5.5 million this year on a 1 year deal. And my thought is, this is based on the idea of he has a good playoff run. But if it was today, where would you be? What would you do if they tabled it and said, we're going to try to buy a contract extension before a playoff run? And yeah, I think it's like the reasons Luke just said, they need the cap space for the blue line and for down the middle. He's a tricky player to evaluate when it comes to what his value actually is, because the point total is low. The cold stretches are ice cold. The injury history is real. The age is 29. And yet it does kind of feel like he's just been becoming a Leaf lately. He's been, as they say with the Yankees, like he's earning his stripes. He's earning his pinstripes. It feels like Bertuzzi's like on the doorstep of that with the Leafs. Whatever that is, I don't like he's earning his blue and white. So I need something better. I need something better than that. And I got to workshop it. But in my ideal world, I would like Bertuzzi on the team. I just don't think it's realistic. I like Bertuzzi more than other people do. I just don't think it's going to end up happening.
What are making his maple?
Oh, it sounds gross. Honestly, that sounds disgusting. I don't know why, but you know what it sounds like, and I don't like it. I don't like it. All right, let's take a quick break. Let's hit what we missed.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right, I'm excited for what we missed today. There was some good stuff in here. All right, let's start. Let's go.
Armin. Well, hockey Twitter, or I was going to say X, but I don't know why you hate that. Hockey X was a buzz yesterday.
Because I'm old, you know this.
But like, anyways, let's not get into it. Zach Hyman just recently scored 50 goals for the first time. He had his first 50-goal season of his career. And one X user was saying that it's not the hard work that apparently the media is pushing that got Zach Hyman to this place, but it's also a majority of all the privilege that he's had to get to this point because he came from a family with wealth.
Yeah, okay. So let me try and summarize what I think he was trying to say. It was Andrew Berkshire, who used to work at Sportsnet. First of all, let me just say, congrats to him on having a take that united every corner of the hockey world against him. Like, that's something, you know? Like, a take. This wasn't him being, you know, a pure villain, like, saying something that we all agree with is outdated and wrong and awful. This was him having an opinion, and every corner of the hockey and sporting... Dude, I got texts about it from people who were not in hockey, going, what the hell is this? I went, yeah, it's wild. It's a wild position. What I think he's trying to drive at, but he did extremely poorly. Like, I think even he would admit it, that he did unbelievably poorly, is ranting for 4 minutes, and it felt personal, and it felt angry, and it was all over the place. It wasn't good. It wasn't a good video. What I think he was trying to drive at, like, trying to be smart about, is the idea that, like, we have now grind and hustle culture. And I'm giving him the, like, ultimate benefit of the doubt here, by the way. Like, I'm trying to squint and see it. We have this grind and hustle culture, right? Which is hard work gets you everywhere. Hard work gets you everywhere. Hard work gets you everywhere. But a lot of people work hard. And a lot of people don't end up getting what they want out of life. And just because you don't succeed at something doesn't mean that you didn't work hard. That some people work hard but also have advantages, and that should be acknowledged when looking at how someone got success, rather than just putting it into one simple categorization of, well, this person's they worked harder than you. I got to tell you, though, he picked the dumbest player to use this for as an example. Justin Bourne, who worked with Zach Hyman when he was with the Marlies, told me a story and has told me this long time. He's talked about this on air many, many times. This is a guy who on the bus was constantly looking at film, never took anything for granted, always wanted to see how he could get better as a player. Actually is that dude who works harder than everybody else, is a universally great guy, and who, despite having these advantages, and all, by the way,
it has been documented. And this guy was trying to be like, no one's ever mentioned it. It's like, it's been mentioned all the time. You can just, I hate when people say that no one's done something and you can be like, maybe mix in a Google before you go with this. Because it's pretty, it's documented, brother. It's out there, bro. Everybody knows that because everyone's brought it up. So stupid. Stupid to do it that way. Sorry, I'm getting fired up because, again, it was done so poorly and I'm trying to kind of defend it all at the same time. Zach Hyman was the worst guy to pick. It was a very odd timing. And it's also, a league where there's a lot of players who are upper middle class. Hockey's not exactly the poor sport. If you watch the NBA and the NFL drafts, basically the second you tune in at 7 o'clock till the time you tune out, it's story after story of, oh my God, can you believe this person overcame this scenario? Hockey doesn't have a lot of those. They got some. Shout out to our boy Anthony Stewart, like, and Chris Stewart, like, those guys did that damn thing. Like, but there is not a ton. There's not an abundance. There's not a overwhelming number of guys that have had to really overcome crazy financial barriers to the NHL, at least in modern vintage, right? Like the NHL as we know it right now. So for him to have singled out this one player for this during this moment felt personal, weird, unnecessary, misguided, whatever you want to say. It missed the mark entirely. It really did. That being said, I'm someone who tries to take swings with takes all the time. So who am I to like ultimately throw stones at a glass house? But I thought this was a bad one. I think that, you know, all you can do in this spot, if you're him, is take the knee and admit that this is an L take. Try to evaluate what you got wrong, own it, and then move on. But yeah, it was, I got to say, when you get some of the people, and I'm not name checking anybody, but when you get some of the people on Twitter who are going, what the hell are you doing? Publicly, what the hell are you doing? Like some of the top journalists in the country is going, what the hell are you doing?
And former players.
Oh, a lot former, of those. But yeah, former players. Yeah. But I'm just saying like, yeah, it was a pretty nutty position. It was a pretty awful position. It was a bad, it was not good. It was not good. But yeah, it's like I said, I don't even think it embraced debate. It wasn't even like everybody got talking and started debating. It was like that. Basically, the debate was how dumb was this? Not was it dumb? You know, like what degree of dumb is this? So yeah, tough one. But interesting, like again, got to tip the cap for creating something that united people in these times where there's so few things. It's a polarizing world. We often are divided on everything, not on this. Everybody was on the same page. So that was nice to see. And two is coming up with something that gets the attention of literally the entire, you know, I'm not saying, sometimes I think we get a little too focused on what's going on Twitter and what's going on X, but I had people reaching out to me going, what's going on here, that legitimately do not have Twitter accounts. So yeah, it was a thing. It was a thing. So I think it's fine we brought it up.
Some good memes that came out of it.
Oh my God,
I gotta say.
Memes. Yeah, yeah.
But the common thread with it that the problem is that you mentioned it at the beginning, is just kind of people see a quote that's used like over the weekend often, multiple times, and they'll take that quote and like pretend like that's the entire narrative about this player just because that quote was what you saw on your timeline this weekend. Mm. It's the recency bias kind of thing that, you know, you accuse me of, but yeah, we all got
I
it.
Don't
but
accuse you, I know it. True. Anyways, what's next?
Well, you mentioned your favorite donuts a few weeks ago.
Yeah, Krispy Kreme, OG.
Coming nationwide, Krispy Kreme donuts are coming nationwide to McDonald's by the end of 2026. That's in the U.S., so I'm assuming that's going to come over here pretty soon. But what? Too dangerous?
So there's two things here at play. One is I'm really pissed off that I didn't buy Krispy Kreme stock ahead of this merger because their stock shot through the roof yesterday and I went, I'm sick. This is supposed to be like, people have areas of expertise, right?
Like, people are supposed to be, oh, well, I'm a car guy, so I'm following the cars and I can jump in on the car. Oh, I'm a crypto guy, I follow the crypto trades, I can I can jump in on this. I'm a technology person, I can follow this, and I know when a technology reveal. I'm just a, like, a, you know, a, like a real fat guy at heart. You know, like, I just, I love bad food.
I was like, where are you going?
I love, like, junk food. It's, you know, I love fast food. I got a trash mouth. I just want to eat all the bad food all the time, you know? Mm-hmm. And so for me to miss out on a once-in-a-lifetime Krispy Kreme stock is inexcusable. It's really, it's got me stepping back. I might have to step back from the show for a while and, like, reevaluate how things are going on in my life. Why I don't like it is I don't need two of the world's most dangerous foods in the same place. Like, I don't need, you know, I would say, yeah, even though you got salads in the menu, that McDonald's isn't exactly healthy food.
Yeah, come on.
Okay, it's fast food. Adding donuts that are supposed to be, like, kind of in a limited amount of shops, like Krispy Kreme 5 years ago was something that was, like, hard to find. You know, you were like, ooh, a couple of Krispy Kreme shops. Like, if you got a Krispy Kreme shop that was around you, someone bringing it in was, that was like a deal. That was like, whoa, someone brought in Krispy Kreme? Poor Mike Jose. Have you ever even had a Krispy Kreme? Because you can't eat anything. Apparently, we just have you had Krispy Kreme before you found out all your allergies? No, you've never even done it? You've never even had it? You can't eat. Our poor guy, Mike Jose, can't eat sugar, which is, like, good for him. He's going to live forever. Mike's going to be the first guy that lives forever. Which is crazy. That's a lot of pressure on you. We're going to study your body for science and be like, this is the, turns out that's the fountain of youth of never eating sugar. But this gets back to Simpson's monkey paw is, hey, would you live forever, but you never get to eat sugar? And I would be like, nah, put me in the grave. It's so good. I love sugar. But
you're right, though. If Krispy Kreme's in your area, that used to be like, oh, you must be in like a trendy area.
Or just, you know, it was a cool thing to have, like, in your spot. And you'd go by, and every once in a while, you know, you snag a box, you snag just one OG or two OGs, and you call it a day. The idea that it's just like right there now, because, okay, I don't care, whatever. I know we're not supposed to talk about like brands and stuff that don't do things. I don't think McDonald's personally does dessert better, like very well. I don't think that there's like an item on the McDonald's dessert menu that's other than McFlurry.
I was going to say Oreo McFlurry.
No, but that's brother, different. That's different. That's, I'm saying there, the baked goods at Mickey D's are not top tier elite. Okay. There's no cookie that's at McD's. When you look in the glass case at the front, ain't nobody going to McDonald's going, man, I got to get myself a brownie from McDonald's. Oh, man, I got to get a muffin from McDonald's. Like, that's not it.
That's true, but the apple pies, I'm just going to say.
Sure, but that's kind of an old school thing. Like, it that's is. That's an old school thing.
Here's a little tip.
What?
Break off half your apple pie.
Okay.
Put it into your McFlurry. You get the hot-cold combination. I'm telling that's, you, bomb.
That's too bomb. Much for me. I got to tell you, I'm old. That would put my stomach. I don't think I would recover from that. I think I would turn into Mike Jose. I think I would turn into Mike Jose where the two of us would be like, we're never eating sugar again. But yeah, I just, now they have a dangerous baked good that's there that you just want to throw in an add-on. I'm like, this is good for us as a society.
I thought of you because, you know, the coffee.
That's what I'm saying.
The just, donuts.
It's too, yeah.
You it's know, the perfect it's a, pairing, really.
It really is. Anyways, congrats to them on this incredible venture. I picture the succession teams of the McDonald's people and the Krispy Kreme meeting up in some, like, being on their choppers, right? Meeting in the Hamptons. And the Krispy Kreme family, them shaking hands, getting the business deal done. Who's the Kendall Roy that poops the bed is the question out of both of those families. I'm sure there's got to be somebody, but yeah. Great on paper, two titans of industry, but dangerous for the rest of us.
I was going to say, McD's, that's like they're competing with Timmy's if they bring that here. I'm just saying not to get too deep into it, but.
Kind of.
With the donuts.
Yeah.
Because their donuts right now suck.
Yeah, they got mini donuts, I think, and I've never had them before. Mm-hmm. The only reason I even know they exist is because when I do Monopoly season and you win the little prizes, it'll be like, you won mini donuts. And I'm like, oh, right. I guess you have those. Never had them. Never will. Anyways, what's next?
Co-star of Happy Gilmore, Christopher
McDonald. I like the picture. I just ruined some big McDonald's deal for sports site where they were like, they were right on the goal line, and then they were like, let's listen to the show. It's a fun show. It's like, McDonald's big good stink. Anyways, go on.
We gave him McFlurry love. But Shooter McGavin, Christopher McDonald, was on Audacity's 92.3 The Fan. That's in Cleveland.
Okay.
And he said,
I like that name. Audacity?
Yeah.
The Fan?
Audacity. Not no. Audacity. Oh.
So Odyssey?
Odyssey. That's what it was.
Holy.
No, but it's not spelled O-D-Y or anything. It's Odyssey.
Send it to me.
A-U-D-A-C-Y. Odyssey.
Okay, yeah. Audacity is better. Yeah, Audacity is actually, I patent that. That's mine. That's mine now. When I create my own station, it's going to be Audacity. Anyways, what's next? The Audacity.
Shooter McGavin was saying that he ran into Adam Sandler a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And he said, McDonald, you're going to love this. And he showed him a first draft
Who's McDonald?
Christopher McDonald, McGavin.
Oh, yeah, McDonald said, you're going to love this. Okay, go on.
And then he showed him a first draft for Happy Gilmore 2.
Uh-huh.
So nothing's confirmed, obviously, but it seems like Sandler's interested. Obviously, to get a movie done, it takes much more than a script. But yeah, it seems like Happy Gilmore 2 might be in the works. What's your what's your thoughts on the original? And here's my question is, do you know any movies that the sequel is better than the original?
I should have thought about this ahead of time. But okay, let me say this. First of all, people have, I actually want to solicit the answers. And people always get mad about food stuff. So follow on Twitter and Instagram. I don't reply to people who don't follow. I don't know why this is such a hard thing to understand. Like, I get these like long stories from people that are like, hey, this is my thing. And you don't follow me on socials. It's like, why would I ever reply? So follow, do all those things. You can reply at any time at JD Bunkus, Twitter and Instagram. This breaks my heart a little bit because I don't think there's, I'm trying to think if there's any even like remotely good
Godfather
sequels.
2?
No, but that's, yeah, that, no, Godfather 2 is great, but it's not better than the original Godfather. But it is very good. Like, that's a great sequel, but we're talking about, you know, the best, two of the best movies of all time. That I actually almost view as like kind of pairing as one. It's Godfather 3, that's the lesser, and that's the one that is a, like, to me, a true sequel, you know? And so that one's not better.
Dude, all the originals are just the ones.
But when they make sequels to comedy movies, especially, and given the change in, you know, climate, especially for comedy movies, right?
Yeah.
The things you could say, the words you could use, the avenues you could use to get a laugh versus what you can do now in a major motion picture, especially for Happy Madison, you know, what is, I believe, a now very family-friendly company that mostly does kids' movies, like Adam Sandler. And I like Sandler's work with kids' stuff. Like, I think that, like, Hubie Halloween or whatever, like, that stuff is funny to me. I enjoy all, like, almost all of Sandler's work. But it's hard for me to envision this being good, like, Anchorman 2 stunk. Like, all these things stink. Actually, you know, can I say, you know what ones were not better than the originals, but what sequels at the time hit but have not held up, I think, as well historically, is the Austin Powers franchise.
Okay.
Austin Powers, like 1, 2, 3, those were all funny.
Goldmember's which one?
2, 3.
Yeah. I think that was the best one. That was my favorite.
Yeah.
So
I think
that's actually a good call.
Yeah, but you're too young. How old are you, Mike? How old is Mike Jose?
27. He's a year younger than me.
Okay. No, he's old enough to, fringy old enough to kind of be, now you had to be there. Like, you had to be a kid. Like, I was a kid when those movies came out, and they were so funny. Like, they were so funny. They were amazing. So I'm saying those were good comedy sequels. But yeah, it's tough, dude. Making sequels is always tough, and especially in comedy. And
man, I thought Happy Gilmore was like early 2000s, 1996.
What are you talking about?
Jesus.
Yes, of course.
I haven't watched it since I was probably 10.
No, it's, to me, Happy Gilmore is in the conversation for greatest comedy movie of all time. It's definitely in the top three for me. Yeah, no
doubt
about it.
That's a big statement.
No, it's definitely there. It's unquestionably there. It's the best Adam Sandler movie, no question about it.
Is it also in your top sports movies then? Or would you rather those be more emotional?
Yeah. I don't view sports movies as that. Like, I view that as a comedy. Yeah. But if you want to add it as a sports movie, sure, it's in the top. But no, I view sports movies as like Remember the Titans, like centered around sports. You got to have like, yeah.
Although there are a lot of
sports scenes in Happy Gilmore. So maybe it should be. I don't know. Like, yeah. But I view it as the sports is the bigger part of the story than the comedy element. But yeah.
We got to do a top sports movies. We've never done that.
Yeah, everybody does that. So obviously,
I know it's really basic,
my secret truth is to most sports movies, though, is like I don't really like a lot of them. A lot of sports movies I'm actually kind of down on. Like, I'm a big Field of Dreams hater. I do love Remember the Titans.
Coach Carter.
I sucks.
What?
Yeah, sucks.
Rich, what? Yeah, Richmond.
See? Yeah, see, like I just
no.
Yeah.
That's I know it. I know that by heart.
I'm a Hoosiers
every
guy
line.
For sure. I'm a Hoosiers guy.
That's a good one. Yeah,
but yeah, no, I'm not a huge sports.
Like Mike, you didn't watch that growing up.
Like Mike, no, that's not on my list. I thought I was making the NBA
after I watched that.
Yeah, of course you did. Yeah, you're a little short guy who's like, yeah, he's gonna make it work. Anyway, subscribe to the podcast, leave 5 stars, follow on Twitter and Instagram, and we will see you tomorrow for Blue Jays home opener day. Busy day tomorrow.